isn't it interesting we pile more on our to-do list but fail to consider things we should stop doing? We create incentives for good behavior, but we don't get rid of the obstacles to achieve that behavior. We collect all sorts of new and improved ideas, but we don't prune the outdated ones. Every day, across challenges big and small, we neglect a basic way to make things better. We neglect to subtract. Hey, it's Dustin, and you're listening to The Burleson Box. We'll be back in a moment to talk with Lighty Klotz about his book, Subtract, The Untapped Science of Less. But first, here's a message from our sponsor.
Are you trying to increase your treatment plan close rates while also increasing revenue? How can you do both for your dental practice without burning out an already burdened staff? The answer? Remote dental monitoring. You need a trusted HIPAA-compliant app that helps you and your staff work smarter, not harder. This needs to be an easy-to-use, easy-onboard app that your patients will find fun to use and will increase their engagement and success with aligners. You need the InHand Dental App. The InHand Dental App allows you to engage with your patients in real time, send individual and batched messages, and solve problems to increase compliance without using up chair time. The result? Happy patients, happy staff, and happy practices. With more revenue and the ability to do more starts. With prices starting as low as $149 a month, it's perfect for a growing aligner business. Check us out and learn more at InHandDental.com. Plus, mention Burleson for a 20% off discount on your subscription when you contact us. That's InHandDental.com.
Lighty Klotz is the Copenhaver Associate Professor at the University of Virginia. He's appointed in the schools of engineering, architecture, and business. He founded and directs the university's Convergent Behavioral Science Initiative. Klotz has earned a highly selective career award from the National Science Foundation and more than $10 million in competitive research funding. He advises influential decision makers who straddle academia and practice, working with the World Bank, the World Design Organization, and Ideas 42, among others. A columnist for The Behavioral Scientist, Klotz has written for venues including Science, Nature, Fast Company, and DailyClimate.org. On today's episode, Lighty and I discuss why it's easy to mistake less for loss, why our first instinct is to add instead of subtract, and how to make the space to go from information overload to wisdom. I'm excited to share these lessons and more from Lighty's new book on another episode of The Burleson Box. Lighty, thank you so much for joining me today. Your new book is fantastic. I'm curious, what motivated you to write about this topic?
Oh, I mean, I'd always been interested in less. And I think, you know, the ideal answer to what motivated really is that, you know, this was just what we had found out through the research and what I had found out through my own kind of exploration was, you know, oh my goodness, this is like the most interesting thing I've ever found. And I need to share it. It would be selfish to keep it to myself. So that's the theoretical answer. I mean, I'll leave it at that. Sorry.
That's good. I loved the story of you and your son playing with Legos. And I was curious if that, you know, might have come before or after the initial idea, and kind of walk us through that exploration.
Yeah. Yeah. And my son is getting famous all over the world, and he's six now. And so it's kind of going to his head, which is like really cute to see. Like I'll say, hey, Ez, you're showing people how to subtract, and he'll put his head in his hands like he can't believe it. And then he'll talk to his friends at school. But yeah, the reason he's getting famous is because when he was three, we were playing with Legos, and basically we were building a bridge, I guess is what you might call it. And the problem we had was that the bridge wasn't level because one of the support columns was longer than the other one. And so I tried to fix this problem. I turned around behind me, grabbed the block to add to the shorter column. And by the time I had turned back around, Ezra had removed a block from the longer column. And so basically the same exact situation, I never even thought of subtracting as an option. And what was really useful about that, I mean, I talked before about how I'd always been interested in this notion of less, but I'd never really been able to like crystallize it into that simple of, you know, what I'm really interested in is this act of taking away that, you know, then gets us to less. And, you know, everything kind of snowballed from there. I mean, Ezra's bridge was really helpful in my thinking about it, but then I was also able to take it to my friend Gabe, who is a co-author on the Nature article that we wrote about some of the research that we did. I said, "Hey, Gabe, try to solve this bridge." And I thought she was gonna, you know, get it right because she's a genius and because she's, I had been talking to her about less and trying to convince her to do research about less. And sure enough, she added like I did. And then she said, "Oh, so what you're trying to say is, you know, why don't we, subtract as a way to make things better?" And so, you know, the bridge was really, it really was a critical moment. It's a great story, but it's totally true. And then it helped me kind of understand how this idea, understand this idea really at its essence, the act of taking away was really critical, and also helped me explain it to other people in a way that makes sense. And, you know, just the way that it's been such a good story to explain it to people like you, it was really helpful in explaining it to Gabe and convincing her to embark on doing research with me.
Yeah. I want to talk about you're in a unique position. I believe you're appointed in three different schools at the University of Virginia. Is that correct? Or three different departments?
Yeah. It means more email, and it's nice. I mean, so my primary appointment's in engineering, and that's where my academic background is from. And, you know, this research that I'm talking about is fundamentally, you know, behavioral science or even psychology. And then I have an appointment in the business school and also in architecture. And I guess where that all overlaps is you know, I'm interested in the science of design. So how do we take things from the way they are to the way we want them to be? And, you know, so Ezra's bridge is an example of that, right? Here's this thing that we're trying to change from a crooked bridge to a level bridge, but so are so many other things in the world, right? So is your calendar, so is your itinerary, your thinking. You know, you can add ideas to your mental models and you can remove ideas from your mental models. It's just this ubiquitous thing that we do is try to change things from how they are to how we want them to be. And I've, you know, always been interested in that in kind of, architectural and engineering standpoints, but this was an opportunity to kind of study it at a much more basic level.
I was kind of cracking up in the book when I read the experiment where you gave people a sample itinerary of Washington, D.C. Walk us through that.
Yeah, that's the best one. I mean, we did all these studies, right? After, it wasn't just Legos. And in fact, you know, no, we never did a study with Ezra's Lego bridge, but we did do some Lego studies where we'd give them a massive Legos and say, "Okay, make this thing better." And everybody added, of course. And then we would do it with writing and with recipes, and eventually we were like, well, let's try to create something that people are actually going to subtract from. And so we created what we thought was a pretty obviously packed itinerary in Washington, D.C. And it was 14 different activities in a single day. I calculated the traffic after the fact, or the driving time after the fact, and it was like two and a half hours worth of driving just in between all of these activities. And we gave that to people and said, "Okay, make this better." And it was this kind of drag and drop interface. So it was really easy to pull stuff out, but they overwhelmingly still added to that itinerary to make it better. They put more things into it. And that was a comical example of, you know, but it is also really illustrative of what we think is happening there, which is that, you know, we just think first when we encounter these situations, whether it's Legos or whether it's a itinerary, we think first about what we can add to make it better. And then never once think about subtraction, because the thing that we found in our studies was that, you know, if it was the itineraries or if it was, you know, grids on a computer screen, for example, once people saw, like if they stumbled upon the subtractive idea, they would realize that it was better. The problem was that they would add and then just move on and think that they were done. So yeah, the itinerary is a great example. And I hope that I don't have as crowded of vacations going forward.
Well, that's why I was laughing as I read it, because there's truth in all humor. And I was thinking, this is something I would do. I would try to add more stuff until someone pointed out, you know, you might actually enjoy your trip better if you subtracted a few things.
Right. So
can you talk about, in the book you say, quote, it's easy to mistake less for loss. And that really resonated with me. Can you talk about why that's true?
Yeah. I mean, it's especially damaging, right? Because we know from other behavioral science, you know, loss aversion and the endowment effect, you know, Daniel Kahneman's won Nobel Prizes for this work is that we're more disappointed to lose something than we are to gain something of the same value. But what we're talking about with, you know, what we found with our research was that this is, people aren't even considering less in the first place. And so if we're mistaking less for a loss, right? So if we're saying that, you know, if we deliberately consider less, right? If we say, okay, I'm going to take this thing let me back up and start that over again. So we know from that research, from Kahneman's research, for example, and like a whole bunch of research after the fact that kind of showed that this is the case in a lot of ways, is that when we lose something, that's more painful than gaining something. But you know, that's where Gabe's shift of the framing was especially helpful. So, you know, what we're interested in is not situations in which subtraction makes things worse. It's situations in which subtraction makes things better. But it is really easy to just say, okay, if we take things away, we're going to perceive that as a loss. And then it falls into this category of loss aversion, in which case we, you know, it's really hard to kind of overcome that emotional feeling that this loss is a really bad thing. So I think, you know, to bring that back into like practical terms, I think that's one of the things, you know, Marie Kondo, for example, she's a master at getting people to subtract in one specific context, right? In tidying your homes. And one of the things that she does is she has people visualize the space that they're going to get. So imagine your future space with the stuff removed, right? So she takes the focus away from the thing that's lost, which is the stuff, and she focuses it on the what's been gained, which is the new room. And so in a way, she's kind of steering us around that tendency to potentially focus on the loss and not focus on the improved less. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you know, I think you go so deep in the book. It's brilliant and it's so well researched. I mean, all the way back to like ancient civilizations and building things and showing competence and like how it fostered civilization. It's amazing how.
Yeah, it's like I think hard-wired. The competence. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, so once we had this finding that, you know, we overlook this, it's like, well, why are we doing that, right? Like, are there biological reasons? Are there cultural reasons? And, you know, the biological reasons, you know, acquisitiveness, right? That, you know, we're wired to acquire food and getting things kind of stimulates those same pathways in our brain. This desire to display competence, I think, is a really key one. I mean, you know, so this is like a fundamental need that we all have, which is basically to show that we can impact the world, right? So, you know, the example I use in the book is bowerbirds building their nests. And they famously build these ceremonial nests. And the whole purpose of the nest is to attract a mate. And we basically, you know, if a male bowerbird builds a fancy nest, it's showing the mate that the male bowerbird can interact effectively with the world. You know, it's healthy enough to pull the sticks around and smart enough to kind of organize them in a pretty way. And And they never use that nest for shelter. Its whole purpose is to show that the bowerbird can be effective in its world. And that's the same reason Ezra's playing with Legos, you know, is to show, hey, I can do things in this world. You know, it's why our kids mimic us. It's why we at work, you know, strive to show that we're doing things. And so like this need to display competence is innate, and it's powerful, and it works against subtraction, right? Because you say, well, how does it, you know, can't you show competence through subtracting? It's like, well, it's a lot harder to show competence if you take something away, right? If you take away a little, you know, I'm looking at my cluttered office right now. And if I take away if I clean up the balloon that's sitting over there and it's deflated and just laying on the floor, if I clean that up, my wife won't notice because it's gone. It's out of sight, out of mind. But but this is where like kind of understanding the science helps, is that you can display competence if you clean up enough, right? If you subtract enough, you can be noticeable in what you've done and therefore display competence. So if I cleaned up this whole room, that would be obvious, and my wife would be proud of me and you know, and recognize my competence as a husband contributing to our household. So that competence is one. And then you mentioned the cultural stuff, which was just fascinating for me because you know, as an engineer, I always like big buildings. Like I talk in the book about, you know, going to the Colosseum in Rome and going to the ruins in Coba. And, you know, I'm just drawn to these big things. It's just, they're awe inspiring. And as I was doing the research into, okay, what might the rise of civilization and culture have to say about, you know, this kind of fundamental, or this desire we have to add, to think of adding before subtracting. This thing that kept coming up was monumental architecture. It seems like the historians and the archaeologists and the anthropologists all have kind of agree that this is like a thing that had to be there for civilization to start. And I, you know, even as somebody who loves big structures, that seemed like a really lofty place for monumental architecture. And, you know, the definition of monumental architecture is basically something that you build that is, has no function really. It's, you know, it's ceremonial. And so like pyramids or even the Washington Monument in the United States. And what they find, you know, in researching throughout history and the rise of civilizations is that this monumental architecture arose at the same time as civilizations, not after the civilization started to thrive, but it's like part of the genesis of civilizations, right with writing and, you know, some of these other in organized religion. And so the point being that it's like, we all kind of come from these cultures, and in that form of physical adding is basic to how we have, you know, to our cultural evolution. I mean, the theory of why it was helpful is that, you know, people had to come together to make these big things. And by building the body of civilization, you kind of built the mind, which is the culture. But in terms of, you know, adding or failure to subtract, I mean, it's certainly a very additive thing to build these monuments.
And that's something I learned in reading your book. I just assumed that monumental architecture came along after a society was kind of successful, but
right,
there's really great evidence that that's totally not true, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, the Washington Monument is the one I used in my book because it was the most recent and because we have a relatively new society. And, you know, if you look at it, when it was completed, it was the tallest building in the world. When it was started, it started before the Civil War. I mean, the U.S. wasn't even a player on the international stage, and Washington, D.C. was this kind of tiny backwater, and then people were like, let's build the tallest building in the world, you know? And so it's amazing.
Yeah, I found that fascinating. I was thinking of like the Roman Colosseum. I was like, yeah, well, they build these things, you know, to show off their power and their, you know, wealth, and turns out, this is really ingrained in who we are. So, mm-hmm. You know, for the listener and reader of this book, understanding why our inherent mode of operation is to just add something else when we're trying to solve a problem, like maybe acknowledge the, you know, the hard wiring in us. But yeah, the book has really great examples and practical applications on how to kind of overcome this. Maybe is this a good time to maybe talk about mental accessibility and how that plays into our ability to see some of this?
Oh, perfect. Yeah. So because I think it allows me to also bring up the point that all of these things are interrelated, these kind of forces. So the mental accessibility, the idea of mental accessibility is just, you know, what are the ideas that come to mind? And, you know, so this going back to kind of our most basic research about this phenomenon that we think of adding first, you know, so we're doing this search process is how the psychologist would talk about it. So you're doing this mental search. You're saying, okay, I've got this situation. Now I'm searching my mind for potential ways to improve it. And adding comes out first. So adding in that case is more accessible. But that's not the only reason that we don't do things, right? I mean, sometimes we might think of subtracting and then choose against it. And all of that gets wrapped into these kind of biological and cultural and then economic forces too, right? Where, you know, there are these other reasons that we might do things in addition to mental accessibility, but also kind of feeding back into mental accessibility. So my friend and, you know, co-researcher Ben, he always talks about like, oh, well, if you're just walking around in this world, and you are constantly reminded of things that we've added, right? Because they're around us. They're either the thing you're doing on your itinerary. They're the house that got built next to yours. They're the ideas that you've added to your brain. And we're not reminded of the subtractions, right? Because they're out of sight, out of mind. So he's like, this differential kind of mental accessibility could just be, you know, could be related to the differential, you know, accessibility of adding and evidence of adding and subtracting all around us.
Wow.
And vice versa, right? So it's, you know, the fact that we see all this adding all around us could, you know, contribute to this kind of mental shortcut that we've developed where, hey, we see all this adding around us, so we assume, hey, that must be the right way to solve problems, and therefore our brains kind of develop this shortcut to go right to adding. And again, it's like they both reinforce each other. It's not one causes the other, but they work together. So that's why it was the perfect question to ask at this point, because that mental accessibility works with these cultural and biological and economic forces, and they all kind of combined to have us where we are right now. And I also think that before we leave the cultural stuff, it's important to point out that, you know, maybe I'm not, first of all, I'm not arguing that adding's bad, right? I'm just arguing that it's bad that we overlook one of our, one of the most basic ways to make change. That's the bad thing. And I think, you know, if I had to choose one or the other, I would choose adding, but we don't, right? I mean, these are both complementary ways to make change. And so, if we could take the, So they're complementary approaches to making change. Let me leave it at that.
Now, a quick word from our sponsor.
The last time you evaluated your credit card processing statement. Our partners at Stax are offering a free savings analysis for our listeners, where they will actually take your merchant statement with your current processor and show you where you're overpaying. Stax has saved orthodontics practices over 40% per month on payment processing costs. So don't wait. Get your free savings analysis today and see how much you're overpaying for your credit card processing. Go to stackspayments.com/Burleson-seminars to schedule your savings analysis today. Plus, as a special offer for our podcast listeners, if you sign up today, you can get your first 2 months of payments processing costs waived from Stax. Once again, that's stackspayments.com/Burleson-seminars. Stop overpaying. Start saving.
And now, back to the program.
I like it. I can think of a lot of issues in the listeners' businesses where, example, in my own life, patients present with a problem or employees come with a new initiative, and we never start with, what are we currently doing that's not working that we should get rid of? We just add more stuff. And I liked in the book how you brought up this topic of mental accessibility because, we don't take enough time to reflect. And I want to maybe circle back in a little bit to the economic drivers of that. And a great example you give in the book of an addition to your house. And I was like, all right, how's he going to do this without adding without adding square feet? And there's a punchline there that we'll maybe get into later. But, I've seen this. I know you've seen it. Obviously, you're an expert at this. And the people listening hopefully have understood that, there's this just overwhelming drive to solve problems or to address challenges in the market or mm-hmm. to try to achieve strategic competitive advantage by doing more, by adding stuff, by right. expansion. And in the book, you talk about something that I'd understood it, but I had never heard it phrased this way. You talk about accessing our multitudes, and that's it can help us see and eventually get to less, which I want to challenge everyone listening, then I'll shut up, is that getting to less is actually harder, right? Even though it doesn't always get acknowledged, it's actually really difficult.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, if I could say one thing, I think that's probably the one thing, right? And I think the paradox there is, that's why we continue to need these reminders from people like Marie Kondo or, Cal Newport with digital minimalism or, Jamie Oliver with 5-ingredient recipes, all the way back to Lao Tzu saying to, to gain wisdom, we need to subtract things every day. And I think that the idea that it's somehow easier to subtract, and in fact, it's harder. It's harder mentally, and then it's harder it's harder to follow through in a lot of ways. So I'm so glad that you brought that up, Dustin. I think that's, again, if there's one thing that could have come across, it's like respect that this is harder. And also, when you're having other people do it, recognize that it's going to take more thought. I will answer the accessing multitudes question, but I think that, I wanted to chime in on your comment about stepping back to reflect too, because that's one thing, what we found in our research is that you're less likely to subtract the more cognitively overloaded you are, right? So the more busy you are, the more stuff on your plate, the more you've added, right? This trap that we're in, the more you've added, the less time you have to kind of step back and reflect. And when you're in that kind of reflective mode of thinking, that's one of the times where you're actually more likely to subtract, because this heuristic that we've found, this search heuristic, is that we add kind of unthinkingly. Now, if you can put some more deliberate thought, you're going to be more likely to subtract. So, So let me go to the accessing multitudes question. And I think this came out of kind of investigating whether some cultures might be better at this than others. Gabe, my co-researcher, was having a beer with a German friend, and I forget if it was German or Dutch, but one of the Germanic cultures. And he's like, oh, well, we don't do that. We don't overlook subtraction. And so, and we have some German samples and Japanese samples, and I assure you they overlook subtraction just as much as the rest of us. And, that's not really the point of the cultural research anyway, right? Because, there are differences in how people perceive the world. There are these kind of more independent views of the world where you're thinking about like, okay, I'm in control of my own destiny. I can shape things around me. And then the more interdependent view where you're thinking, okay, everything is relational, and everything moves back to this kind of central equilibrium. And we all have some of each of those. And there's not really good evidence that one or the other is better at subtracting. And even if there was, there's nothing you could really do about that evidence, right? I couldn't say, hey, Dustin, well, you can subtract better if you were born in Germany, right? Even if that was true. And so the point here is, you know, we've all got these multitudes in ourselves. We've all got these more kind of independent ways of thinking. And these are the kind of dominant kind of cultural differences, basically, is like interdependent ways of looking at the world and independent ways. But we all have some of each, and we all can access some of each at different times. And, you know, one example, when I'm thinking about myself, you know, let me think of a time when I'm really independent. I used to play soccer. So when I was playing soccer, it was very independent view of the world. I mean, yes, I had my interdependent teammates, but it was like win or lose, right?
Yep.
Zero sum game. You either win this game or you don't. I'm going to do whatever it takes to try to win. And then interdependent is like when I'm a father, you know, I've got my kids around and my wife, and, you know, how do I kind of do what I can to help this family, and how are we all kind of in this together? And so there in me, I have like these kind of two different multitudes that I can access at different times. And I think if you're trying to solve problems, and in particular, if you're trying to think of subtraction more, you can try accessing both of these multitudes. And, but again, it's evidence that it's more work, right? Because I'm telling you, hey, you got to access multiple multitudes to try to do this. Think of this basic way to make change.
Yeah, I love that. It was eye opening for me, because I think it's a tendency in my own business just to, you know, trudge forward, just keep going down the same path, and taking time to really think about, you know, from all aspects, are we on the right path? You know, are there things that we can absolutely stop doing? And So that's one big takeaway since reading your book, is that, you know, we start every meeting with kind of what's working well, what needs addressed, but, you know, what are we doing that we could probably stop? And,
you really do that? That's awesome.
Yeah. It's been fun, because, you know, in every aspect of the business, from how we, you know, welcome new patients to how we hire and train. It's just, I mean, there are so many widgets and, you know, pieces of software and just technology just bolted onto the practice that probably, like, I think of a friend who owns racehorses, and, you know, he says the first thing we do when something's not working right is we strip it all off. Like, we get all the gear that's been piled. Like, this trainer added that thing on his leg, and this trainer added this thing to his gait and his eye, and they strip it all down. So
interesting.
We
were talking a little about the doctor stuff before we started, but like my neuroscientist neighbor, the reason he brought it up was in the context of basically deprescribing, which I had never heard of. But I mean, as I understand it, the problem is that, you know, the same thing as the racehorse, basically, is like people go into a doctor, they get prescribed one medication, and then the next time they go in, that they're evaluated based on this person plus this medication. And it just, there's never this kind of consideration. Oh, well, what if we stripped it all down, then maybe would like a different medication be appropriate. It's hard, but I think, I mean, what you're doing in your meetings is exactly right. Based on the science, is that, you know, to think of it first, to subtract first, and then also to ensure that you have these cues, because, you know, what the research shows is that we don't tend to think of it. It doesn't show that we can't think of it. It's just, we aren't going to think of it on our own. So, but if you do bake into these cues into your process, where you're constantly asking yourself, hey, what doesn't serve us well? I mean, that should, hopefully that's helpful. I'd be interested to hear how it works out.
Yeah. It's been wonderful. And, you know, it'll be a learning process, but I think, it, you know, counterintuitive for sure, because prior to that, almost always was, you know, are we going to do, what of all of these things on the list are we going to be able to do this quarter? And how does that tie into our vision and mission? And I think it's probably been about 4 years now since we just specialize in pediatrics. We only do kids and teenagers. But for years, you know, a significant portion of our business was adults. And that took years to finally make the decision to stop doing that, because we were really inefficient at it. The clinic really wasn't set up well for it. It was just unprofitable as well as a business owner. And I mean, had I had your book back then, hopefully you never know, but hopefully it wouldn't have taken me years to come to that decision. But anyways, I really appreciate that. And hope everyone listening goes back and kind of goes through that section of the book to give yourself more time and to access more than just one way of thinking about the problem. You give a lot of great examples in the book. I'm curious if you have any favorite examples of how, I know the example of removing a freeway in San Francisco kind of starts the book. That mm-hmm. was really exciting for me to read about how that came to be. I don't know if you had maybe a favorite one you could share.
Well, since you just talked about pediatrics and I love the balance bike example. So these are those like bikes for 2-year-olds, and what the innovation is that they removed the pedals. And so whenever I see one with a little kid rolling around on one of those balance bikes, I just get disappointed that this wasn't invented when I was a kid, because, you know, basically the kid pedals the bike like a Fred Flintstone car. And the innovation is just to take away the pedals, right? And there's been hundreds of years of bike innovation where people are saying, oh, training wheels, you know, there's these gadgets that attach the kid's bike to the adult's bike, all these additive innovations. And it took so long to kind of get a commercialized version of, hey, there's no pedals, and this actually helps the kid ride sooner. And then the cool thing about these balance bikes is once you not only do you get these extra years of biking as like a 2-year-old, but once it's time for your big kid bike, as we call it in my house, you don't need the training wheels because you already know how to balance, and you just need to know how to pedal, and then hopefully brake. So yeah, that, I would say balance bikes are definitely a favorite example. And then like to give you a, you know, it's not just a physical world thing, like music. I really like Bruce Springsteen, and one of his most kind of critically acclaimed albums is Darkness on the Edge of Town. And one thing that's critically acclaimed about it is that he really stripped down the instrumentals and then also the lyrics, so that it's an example of what we were talking about before, of how you can show competence through subtracting. You just have to do a lot of it. And so it was so stripped down that people thought, oh my goodness, this is different. This is not like anything we've heard from Springsteen or from anybody else. And so it was this example of subtracting in music that kind of showed, hey, this is a very competent subtraction that has made the world better.
And probably I'd have to go back and reread. You could tell us the interview covered in the book with Springsteen, but probably harder, more difficult to make that album, right? I mean, if you're just stripping everything down.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're not a Springsteen fan, I mean, one of the things he's just famous for is his dogged work ethic. I mean, the dude's 72 years old or something right now, and he's still churned out 2 albums and a book in the time it took me to write 1 book that was shorter than his book. And so, yeah, he's like, he definitely works hard. And Darkness, like, when he was recording the songs for that album, he recorded like 50 songs that he's, you know, released kind of 30 years later. And people are like, oh, these songs are pretty good too. And so he had stripped songs out of it too. So yeah, certainly harder, right? Because he had done all this work to create, you know, more than 60 songs. And then he just picked the best ones to put on the album. And then they were stripped down kind of at that level too. So again, you know, it's a really clear example that you need to do more to get to this notion of less.
To get to less, yeah. I thought it was a big takeaway for me in the book was that, you know, in every industry there's a, I don't know if it's a just a inertia or status mm-hmm. quo. There's kind of this tendency to stop at good enough. And I think a lot of music stops at good enough. It's okay, mm-hmm. We've only got so much time, or we only have so much budget. Or years ago, there's only so many records that can fit into a record shop. There's only so much time on the radio. And so, you know, I think maybe that was a gatekeeper decision, but you talk about it in the book, you call it satisficing. I don't know if I'd ever heard that word before, but I like it.
Or you haven't yet.
Got it in the margins. Did you invent that word?
No. Oh, God, no. I wish the person who had invented it had invented a better word. But the so it's a term by Herbert Simon. So, you know, like Kahneman and Tversky are kind of this, I would think of it as kind of the second wave of revolution in psychology, showing that people are irrational, you know, to just to paraphrase. But Herbert Simon was kind of the first wave, and he also won a Nobel Prize. And, you know, what he showed was that people don't optimize every single decision, which makes perfect sense, right? I mean, you've got a limited amount of time in the day. If you're going to, you know, pick out spaghetti sauce at the supermarket, and there are 1,000 options, and you just want the one that is, you know, below some kind of price threshold and maybe has, you know, doesn't have onions and doesn't have a ridiculous amount of salt, for example. So you just want a satisfactory decision there, because then you can go home and spend time with your family, which is maybe you want to optimize the decisions there. So there's all these decisions that we make, not by getting an optimal solution, but by just by getting a satisfactory and sufficient solution. And that's where Simon combined those words to come up with satisficed, and that's kind of endured. And it describes this tendency to just stop at good enough, which we do all the time. And most of the time it serves us well. Like, I'm not going to stop using that process for picking out my spaghetti because it's satisfactory. But this tendency to stop at good enough when it comes to subtracting can be harmful. And that's, you know, what we found in our experiments was that people would, for example, well, let me describe our grids. So we eventually came up with this paradigm where there was a pattern of grids on a computer screen, and the pattern was broken into 4 quadrants. And the challenge was for the participants was to make this thing symmetrical. And what we would do is just put extraneous marks in one of the quadrants. And so when we said, okay, make this symmetrical using as few clicks or actions as possible, they could either add blocks to 3 of the grids, which was more work, or they could subtract from one of the grids, which was less work. And what they would do, they, you know, overwhelmingly added as in the other experiments, but what they would do is add to all of the 3 grids and say, okay, got it. And then they moved on. When we had them do it multiple times, said, okay, solve this multiple ways, they became more likely in the later iterations to eventually realize that, like, hey, subtracting was one way to do this. And then when we subsequently said, okay, well, which way would you pick of all the ways that you tried, which one was the best? They obviously recognized that subtracting was the better way to solve it, and they chose it. So what's happening there is that they kind of get that good enough solution and just keep going. And I think that in that case, it's just cognitive satisficing. But, you know, some of what you're describing too, you know, this happened to, I did construction management before I went back for my PhD and went into academia. And, you know, once you've satisfied the client, there's very little financial incentive to do more, right? So if you're an architect designing a school, which was, you know, some of the things that we worked on, and you've got a school that the client says, oh, that looks good. That looks like the other school we've got over here. Sounds good. There's very little incentive to kind of keep going and strip out elements of that design that would actually make it better. So there's all kinds of reasons we would satisfice, and it's damaging when we think of adding first and then satisfy and don't keep going and then take away. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. News today, I saw an article on that fast food is now going to these multi-use, you know, containers. So instead of a single-use disposable cup or burger container, they're putting them in these plastics you can, you know, dishwasher safe, take home and use. But a really smart person said, you know, the worst possible scenario here is that people take these and just use them once and throw them away. Like, no one thought about how can we get away from giving every single item, you know, to a consumer and something that gets immediately thrown away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that goes back to, well, it's good. So economically, it might be good enough, right? It might satisfy mm-hmm. the shareholders or right. the business owner, but, you know, environmentally might be one of the worst decisions we ever make. I want to go back to that experiment because I think maybe in the Nature article there was a feature and I got to see a video of people doing that. Smart how you design that. And then when you overloaded them cognitively, showing like I think it was like push a button when you see a five or something. It was really fascinating.
You got it exactly right.
That I want to dovetail that into information overload, just being constantly bombarded with new information. We're contributing to that today by giving listeners another podcast to listen
to. No, this is not something to subtract. This is time well spent. And it's add and subtract. It's not like information's bad. It's just we need to take control of it. So
when I got towards the end of the book, it was clear to me that this isn't a zero sum game. It's not add or subtract. It's how to figure out how to do both. We talked a little bit about giving yourself space and time to kind of step back and reflect.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that maybe today in information overload? I don't know if you've seen any difference with maybe people you've worked with or other experiments you're working on where, I guess, obviously cognitive overload and information overload don't help. Are those things we can do to give ourselves space and time? Have you found some that work really well, either for you or for your students?
I mean, personally for me, I think this is, people often ask, hey, did you get better at this through doing the research? And I think this is one area where I'm proud to have improved because, I love information. I'm a professor and I love ideas. And I mean, I used to run on a treadmill while I'm listening to a podcast, while I'm, catching up on the news on the TV. So, obviously you've got to bring information in, but also that didn't leave me any time to synthesize. And so now, a practical thing that I've done is just on my runs, I've decided that that's going to be a synthesizing time. And so I'll unplug and go for my run, and it's a different kind of thinking, but I wouldn't want to just be running all day and not ever bringing in new information and just kind of be with the thoughts in my head. But it was really important to kind of intentionally clear out that space to allow my thought process to kind of, subtract some things or to, focus in on what's important. So that's like a really tangible thing that I did. And I think that all of us can do, and that some of the, Cal Newport's book on digital minimalism is really kind of helpful with that, or on deep work. And kind of relieving that burden. It's subtracting ideas is one of the hardest things to do. I mean, one of the stories I tell in the book, I was started to look into the education research and see, okay, well, how do teachers subtract wrong ideas when a kid, like my son who's now six comes in and thinks that, there's robot hamsters. How does the teacher help the kid subtract that idea? And there's this whole industry, but line of study on how do we remove misconceptions? And they eventually gave up because it was hard to subtract misconceptions. They're like, well, that just doesn't work. We've got to help them reframe the misconceptions. And there were some problematic things about subtracting misconceptions because it would kind of, obviously you don't want to have, some kid come in with a different cultural background and then the teacher's telling them that those are misconceptions, right? So you wanted, it was good that they've made this shift to kind of working with them, but it was just really interesting that they found it so hard to get people to subtract these ideas, and not just in kids, but in grownups too, that subtracting wrong ideas is really hard. And so, I wish I had a really easy way to do that. One of the things I talk about, well, let me tell, I love the grown-up story of people doing this. So there's this guy, Leon Festinger, who's a famous psychologist, and he joined this doomsday cult. And it was a brilliant move because what he was studying was how do people change their beliefs? And so he joined the doomsday cult. And if before the doomsday came, and his idea was that, well, if the doomsday comes, then I'll be in the cult, so I'll be all set. But if it doesn't come, I'll have this fascinating case study of how people change their beliefs. And most of us aren't cult members, but we all do the same basic thing. So what happened when, the doomsday was supposed to come at midnight, and at first people started arguing about which clock was the official clock of the doomsday. So it's okay, well, maybe that clock's wrong and the doomsday is coming in 5 minutes. Just hang on here. And then, And then they, you know, kind of time kept going and kept going. And by the, basically by the morning, they had shifted their thinking around to say, okay, the end of days was going to come, but because we had been so like vigilant in our belief, we staved it off. And so they were heroes. So they didn't change their beliefs that the doomsday was in fact coming. They just kind of shifted around. We all do kind of similar things when we're presented with evidence that doesn't match up with what we like. Anyway, yeah, so it's just hard. And I think, you know, absent this reminder, okay, hey, we can also subtract wrong ideas, I think analogies can be helpful. And that's one thing from the science that is useful. So basically, and the reason the analogy is helpful, so, you know, what I just described was, okay, people just hold on to their initial ideas, right? And you present them with some kind of evidence to the contrary, and it's hard for that evidence to overcome the existing idea. But if you buttress the evidence with an analogy that they already believe, then you've essentially got like kind of that evidence plus the analogy fighting against the wrong idea. And then you've got a better chance at kind of changing the idea. So, you know, I really wish I had a, hey, here's how to do it. because I think this is like the ultimate thing here is how to subtract these wrong ideas. But that's one way. And I think just, you know, kind of thinking about subtraction can be helpful.
Yeah. And just acknowledging it. I was laughing the whole time with the doomsday cult. Cause I mean, we all do that, you know, like not as a cult member,
right.
I hope, but I was thinking of like employees, like training new employees. They come on the team and there's some area of the training they're just not getting, or they're not up to speed, or they show up late, or they miss a day and don't call in sick. And we immediately go to like, well, it's like it's the same thing as like, well, we must have the wrong clock. Clearly it's a doomsday. And we'll say like, you know, the employee clearly is, you know, not a hard worker or hasn't, you know, got the right mindset, but we never look at our training, right? We never actually look at, well, maybe there's no such thing as a doomsday. Maybe you actually, right. We're wrong. We didn't put them in the right program. Maybe we hired the wrong person. It's not them. Maybe we put them in the wrong role. And I mean, right. I think I do that all the time in our business where we see issues that it's not, you know, it's just, it's so easy to ignore than to remove a wrong idea in the business. But it starts, I mean, your book is a great place to start with acknowledging what, you know, why and how we do that. And then looking at the hard task of getting rid of some things, you know, in my business, getting me out of that role, you know, when I tended to, the first 5 or 10 employees, I hired them all. So they all looked like, sounded like, behaved just like me, which is a nightmare for everyone else. And, you know, I had to subtract myself out of that part of the business, but, you know, I just, anyways, we could talk all day about that.
Well, no, that's a good, I wanted to, cause I talked to, Bob Sutton, who wrote Good Boss, Bad Boss. And he reached out after I wrote the book because he's really interested in like organizational friction and how to get rid of that. And one of the things we talked about was like, it seems like we'd be better at doing it for somebody else or having somebody else subtract for us, right? Because that overcomes some of this, you know, hey, this is a thing that I made. And, you know, our research actually, when I was like, oh, Bob, I think I have some evidence for that. And because when we had people modify writing, they were more likely, twice as likely to subtract, in fact, from somebody else's writing as from their own writing.
Yeah.
And I think the same would go with, you know, yeah, like, hey, overhaul the human, you know, the onboarding process and, you know, maybe not having the person who made the onboarding process do that could lead to more subtraction. I also think, you know, what you've done in your meetings, you know, asking these processes that don't serve us well, that same kind of cue should work for the ideas where it's like this regular thing that's like, okay, what are the things that we believe and which ones don't we believe anymore? And I think just that kind of like regular check-in should be really helpful. And I mean, I think, you know, if the book does what I hope it does and what I think it is doing in the medical community, at least that I see, is that it gives smart people or thoughtful people this new lens of looking at the world. And I think by understanding the why more, by seeing these examples of how people have subtracted in all these different contexts, you're going to be able to to figure out, you'll be closer to figuring it out or have more ideas for using it in the situations that matter for you. So, you know, I haven't prescribed, here's the 10 steps to use this in a, you know, a small medical company. But I do think that somebody who runs a small medical company can kind of take the book and come up with 10 better steps than I ever would have been able to.
This is such a great, great contribution to society and to the literature. And we are grateful you wrote it. I'm going to include in the show notes the link to your Nature article. And I do believe it was the one of the Strider bikes that caught my eye in the Washington Post. We'll link to all that because it's just fantastic. So I know we're getting close to the end of our time together. I want to make sure everyone has a chance to find out, you know, clearly what you're researching, what you're doing, obviously read more and learn more about the book. Can you tell us where listeners can go to learn more about you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm on Twitter now, and then also lightyklotz.com is my website. And the book. Or just Google. I have a great Google name. my parents had good foresight.
I'm so grateful you came on the program. Thanks for being here, Lighty. Thank you for writing the book. It's been an absolute honor.
Well, thank you, Dustin. This was the best set of questions I've had yet. And it was a lot of fun and thought-provoking for me. So I really appreciate your contribution to my thinking.
You've been listening to another episode of the Burleson Box, where we bring you and your team leaders into the conversation with today's best authors and business leaders. If you enjoyed the program, be sure to share us with a friend or colleague. Visit theburlesonbox.com, where you can sign up to receive my monthly reading list, all the study guides for each of the books and authors we interview, or give us a call at 1-800-891-7520. We can talk about how a Burleson Box membership, monthly coaching, or our annual leadership conference can work for you and your team leaders. Be sure to listen each month for new resources to help you and your employees serve your patients with excellence. And until next time, remember the words of Margaret Atwood, who said, "I read for pleasure, and that is the moment I learn the most." Go make it a great month, and I'll see you right here next time on the Burleson Box. Dr. Burleson here. You've heard that real estate should be a part of every investor's portfolio, but maybe you're unsure where to start. My good friend and colleague, Dr. David Phelps, leads an investor community that has ditched the traditional Wall Street model for the stability of real estate assets. They are called Freedom Founders, and they do real estate really, really well. David's Freedom Blueprint reveals exactly how much you need to retire. Some of my top clients have done the program. They speak highly of David and his Freedom Blueprint. With the certainty of their passive real estate investments, Freedom Founders members are free to spend more time with family or even leave the practice altogether. David has put together some special resources for my listeners. To access, just text Dustin to 972-203-6960 or go to freedomfounders.com/Burleson.